listeners who support this NPR station.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, the birth rate is down in the U.S., and we're going to talk about why that is. Our next guest says that there is a birth strike by women here in the U.S. We'll talk about what that means in just a moment. First, two listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we were talking about the changes in U.S. policy toward Cuba, making it harder to travel to Cuba, also making it harder for people to send remittances to their families in Cuba, and also opening up the doors to lawsuits against U.S. companies and other companies that are doing business in Cuba. Here's what two listeners had to say.
Susan from Anna Maria. I, too, have been to Cuba, went for Christmas, and the Cuban people are absolutely fabulous. They don't complain, and there's a certain, vulnerability. It's kind of beautiful with them because they haven't been, exposed to a lot of things that we have because we seem to be so spoiled over everything. And to this day, we had a guide, a 23-year-old university student, Catherine Garcia Hernandez, and I absolutely love her. But anyway, I can't say enough about it. It was not what I expected. Of course, we went on a cruise, and so, of course, you know, we saw the pretty side of it. Anyway, a lot of rich history. Like I said, it was not what I expected. I was surprised that they have email, and I'm hoping that President does not undo what President Obama has done or, you know, mess with it. They have great attitudes and very, very loving people, and it was such a great experience. I urge everyone, anyone to go. I felt safer there than I have in some of the cities in America.
It's Wendy Schultz. I was listening to your show this morning, and I totally loved everything about your guest, all of his, you know, opinions and everything. I was fortunate enough back in the late 90s to sail to Cuba a couple of times, and it was an incredible experience. I interacted with the locals a lot, and they were all super well-educated, you know, seemingly happy in their circumstances, if you will. One of the things that I found most striking, and he brought it out in his last comment, was the Capitol building in downtown Havana is this giant, you know, beautiful structure, and it's got 20-foot doors that have brass friezes of the Cuban history. And after the revolution, they etched out every picture that had Batista in it. Those people left there, they hate Batista. It's crazy. And what we're doing to Cuba is, it's beyond everything. And thank you for bringing your programming and your guests to this radio station. I am so glad you're back.
A couple of listener comments that came in after yesterday. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Well, our next guest points out that in 2017, the birth rate in the U.S. reached an all-time low. And in her new book, Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work, activist and author Jenny Brown argues that declining birth rates represent a work slowdown or a strike in the face of the poor conditions for those who do the job of bearing and raising children. And Jenny Brown joins us on the phone. She'll be speaking Monday night in Tampa. And Jenny, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
So where did this term birth strike come from?
Well, birth strike was an early 20th century term used by people who were advocating rights to birth control. Emma Goldman used to tour around and do what she called her birth strike lecture, talking about how women needed the right to control their reproduction. So we think it's an appropriate term for what we're seeing recently. In our group, National Women's Liberation, we did a consciousness raising in 2015 where we discovered that a lot of our members had one child and wanted a second but couldn't figure out how to make it work, based on the expense of childcare, the expense of health care, the time crunch with both parents working all the time, and all these things were really conspiring to make it so that women who wanted more kids couldn't have them. And then we also noticed that some of us, and I was certainly in this category, wanted to have kids, but in particular, in my case, I didn't have reliable health care, so that really puts it out of reach of a lot of people. And this is not how things are arranged in other countries where they actually provide some assistance.
Now, this isn't a conscious decision. I mean, there's not like leafleting and picket signs and, you know, picket lines. I mean, it's not an organized birth strike. This is just, are you saying this is a reaction by women to the conditions that they face here in the U.S.?
That's exactly right. And the U.S. isn't the only country to face a decline in the birth rate. You know, Sweden, France, a lot of countries, in fact, most of the developed world now has much lower birth rates than are required to sustain the population. But one of the things that other countries have learned that we haven't decided to do yet is that if you're going to have women going out to work, if you're going to require that both of the people in the family are going to be out and doing 40 hours a week, then you have to have some kind of support. And one of the supports that they've come up with is to have very long paid leave. Long paid leave, for example, 2 years, up to 2 years in France. And this is both parents can take parts of this paid leave. In Sweden, it's 16 months. The other thing that they figured out is, we could have, child care that's really quality child care that everybody has access to, sort of free like the public schools. And so once they instituted those things, it made it easier for families to decide to have kids. And so their birth rates have gone back up to replacement rates. But what we see here in the U.S. is we've seen just more and more intense politics around abortion and birth control. And, you know, we were always told that the reason for abortion politics the way it is that, you know, there's this politicians are sort of pandering to a religious base. They don't really care about abortion, but they want to get those votes. But what we've seen lately with the attacks on birth control is that, even 80% of people who are against abortion are for birth control. So these politicians are not pandering to that base. They're going against what the base wants. So we think that it's time to bring all of this fight out into the open.
Well, our guest is Jenny Brown. She's the author of a new book called Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. I want to go back to those days of Emma Goldman. If we go back 100 years and look at the women who are fighting for abortion rights or reproductive rights, they were claiming that the government of the time in the U.S. wanted them to have a lot of babies. So you tell me if I'm wrong. So that these babies could end up to work in the factories and to go to war. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was a big one on big families. He would go around promoting big families. He would give medals to families that had 10 children. And his explicit reason was, you know, the U.S. was starting to be an empire, starting with the invasion of the Philippines. It required a lot of people. And so they were very explicit that a strong country militarily meant they needed a large population coming up. And this was a response to feminists really from 1848 really demanding to have a life aside from childbearing. I mean, in 1800, the average number of children per woman was 8. And by 1900, that was 4. So they were really making a change in using birth control and abortion to do it. And this really made the elites of the time were very panicked about it. They didn't like to see the birth rate go down, and so they tried to make sure that women didn't have any other options through discrimination, and tried to push women back into the home to have lots of kids. It hasn't worked, but that has sort of been the perennial thing.
So if that was then, 100 years ago, what is the reason for the, and it's still, I think it's fair to say it's still strong, what is the reason now for this strong anti-abortion movement? What's your take on that?
Well, I think some of it is religion, but if you look at history, you know, abortion was legal in this country up to 4 months from the founding of the country for 100 years. So it's not until 1873 that you see a nationwide ban on abortion, and then we had 100 years of abortion being banned. And at the time, the reason given was not prudery, which is what we usually hear, like it was obscenity or there was an anti-sex thing. What the main reason given at the time was that white Anglo-Saxon Protestant women were not having as many kids, and the new immigrants bringing this sort of alien religion, namely Catholicism, were having many more babies. So they were very concerned about that, and they were concerned about women really having their own thing and being able to do their own thing and get out in the workforce. And so there's very much, I think, similar things going on now. I mean, I Steve King of Iowa, this representative from Iowa, is tweeting about, you know, we can't rebuild our civilization on somebody else's babies. You hear all of this horrible anti-immigrant rhetoric. And it really echoes what they were saying in the 1870s. There's really this idea that, immigrants are going to come and change the nature of the country. And of course, the U.S. is an immigrant country, and it's always been true. So, but I think that some of the intense anti-immigrant politics has also been related to this question of the birth rate.
I want to ask you another question about people of color in a moment, but with all the efforts to curtail access to abortion here in the U.S., and I think across the country, many state legislatures and governors are Republican. They've moved against abortion rights. In some places, abortion clinics are closing down. There's lots of restrictions on abortion. At the same time, you point out in your book that the birth rate in the U.S. is at an all-time low. How do you reconcile those two things? Why is that? Because they are making efforts. The anti-abortion movement is making efforts to curtail access to abortion services. So yet people are still having fewer babies.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in some cases they have been successful in forcing women to have kids that they didn't want to have. In Texas, when the law came down in 2012, it closed almost 80 abortion and reproductive rights clinics. When birth control was no longer available in those parts of Texas, the birth rate went up rather sharply. So I do think that women are being coercively forced into pregnancies that they would otherwise not not have. And in fact, our unintended birth rate in this country is about twice that of countries where there's good access to abortion and birth control. So I do think that the coercion is having some effect, but it's not having enough to get the birth rate back up. And I think that's because women are just, as has been true throughout our history, if you make abortion harder to get, women are extremely determined when they need to control their reproduction, they will do it. Despite all kinds of obstacles and expenses, it's a very intense situation that where women are just not willing to buckle under to what they're being expected to do.
Well, Jenny Brown is a member of the National Women's Liberation Organization, and she's the author of Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work. She'll be speaking this coming Monday at 6:30 at the National Nurses United Hall, which is on North 19th Street in Tampa. She argues that we're experiencing a low birth rate here in the U.S., because the employers don't want to put the resources that it would take to making having a child appealing in this country. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. I want to go back to the, you were talking about this fear of immigrants. There really are two minds in this country about who should have access to reproductive services. And you point out in your book, Birth Strike, that our attitude towards African-American women is far different than our attitude toward white women.
Yeah, I mean, the history of this, of course, goes way back to slavery, and And you can see kind of the power structure going back and forth and being very, having a dilemma because, so in, at the founding of the country, when we have slavery, they are a little bit nervous and they get really nervous when the Haitian Revolution occurs, in 1791. They get really nervous that these captured Africans that they have, in bondage are going to rise up and overthrow them. So there's always this nervousness about the balance between, the black population and the white population. And you see that, however, of course, they are completely dependent on the black people that are working their plantations for their wealth. And in fact, during slavery, of course, black women's reproduction really was reproducing the wealth of the South. It wasn't just that black people were creating the wealth of the South with their work. They also were counted as the wealth of the South because they were owned by white people. So, so this situation meant that they wanted to have enslaved women have as many babies as possible, and this caused all kinds of horrible reproductive coercion. And then you see during the period after slavery, in the Great Migration, when African Americans move out of the South, there's a desperation by the big landowners to keep their labor on the land, and they pass all kinds of laws against vagrancy, or you can't move if you have debt. And they even, you know, they even arrest people to prevent them from getting on trains to go to Chicago or New York or Detroit, right? They tear up people's tickets. They stop trains from actually stopping at stations. I mean, it's a whole thing to try to keep the labor there. Well, what happens after World War II is that there's a labor shortage during the war, and the cotton production is partly mechanized. And so this throws a lot of folks out of work at the same time that black GIs are coming back from having fought for democracy overseas and wanting to see a little more democracy at home. So this kind of panics the big Southern landowners, and they eventually, by the 60s, they have fully mechanized the cotton harvest and chopping jobs. So there's no, like, suddenly they have a population that is unwanted from their perspective, and then you start to see forced sterilization coming in, and this is not just directed at black women, but black women bear the brunt of it. It's directed at women on welfare, anybody who's regarded as undesirable. Certainly Mexican American women and Native American women also experience this. So this is kind of the 60s population, what we think of as the overpopulation scare came down to forcing, preventing women from having kids by forced sterilization. So that's the history there. And but what we see now, it's very interesting. What we see now is really a lot of splits in what should be done about the lower birth rate. I mean, you see, on immigration, you see there's one faction which is represented by Trump and Pat Buchanan and Steve King. They're very virulently anti-immigrant faction. And then there's another faction that's represented by, you know, former Governor Jeb Bush, who wrote a book called Immigration Wars, where his priority is he's very worried that, for example, the spending countries like Mexico have a lowering birth rate, and he's worried that there won't be enough immigrants to fill jobs. So his idea is to increase guest worker programs, which is kind of a euphemism because, of course, basically what that means is you're here in the country to work, and if you lose your job, you can be deported immediately. This is of course, great for employers because they have total control of their workforce. And then the other thing that Jeb Bush is against is family reunification. So he doesn't want people to bring their kids and their parents eventually the United States when they immigrate here, because, and he's very explicit, he says, this will cost us money. You know, we'll have to spend money on schools, we'll have to spend money on health care. So, but what they really want in this faction is they really want the expenses and the time and the effort of raising the new generation to be put on other countries, and basically U.S. employers to benefit but to never pay anything in. So that's kind of the factions. But you'll also see, I mean, even with the Trump faction, he is, you know, at the same time he's blockading the border to women and children seeking asylum, he's increasing the amount of guest worker, the H-2B program by 30,000 people. So clearly, you know, they have this dilemma. They need the work, but they don't want to pay for it. And so that's sort of the theme that has come through.
Well, our guest is a veteran feminist, Jenny Brown. Her new book is Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work. She was a leader in the fight to get the morning after pill here in the U.S., and she argues that the record number of women who are declining to have children, they're doing so because they don't have the social or government support, such as paid parental leave and universal health care and easy access to daycare to raise children without problems. Jenny, I was just talking to one of my coworkers a moment ago before I came into this interview. She has a lot of friends who are women in their 30s. They're not having kids because they fear what the world's going to be like in 20 or 30 years, things like climate change. Does that play into your book?
That has come up. When we do consciousness raising, it's usually among like the top 10 things that people cite as reasons that they don't want to have kids. It's definitely in the mix. But I think for a lot of people, that you know, they want to have kids because they feel that, you know, we do need to be hopeful about the future, and we do need to fight for example, good climate change legislation, a Green New Deal, that there is hope. But I can understand, you know, some people are feeling very nervous about it, and that is certainly playing into it a little bit in my experience of talking to a lot of women about this.
Jenny Brown will be speaking Monday night at the National Nurses United Hall, which is at 1406 North 19th Street in Tampa at 6:30 p.m. So, Jenny, you say that other countries have figured out a way around this, that if they want to keep, you know, just replace the current population, that other countries are much more friendly to women and to young parents than our country is. Do we have parental leave in the U.S.? Is there any mandate that employers provide parental leave, paid parental leave?
A couple of states now do have paid parental leave. I think it's now up to 5. The problem is that it's very short. It's usually 6 to 8 weeks, and it's not a good percentage of your original income, so like 60%. So, but we don't have any federal paid leave policy. We're really one of only 3 or 4 countries in the world that doesn't have some kind of paid maternity leave program. 50 countries actually provide 6 months or more paid. So when we talk about 6 or 8 weeks, we're really talking about a drop in the bucket we're basically a huge outlier in the world. And this includes countries that don't have a lot of money and countries that do have a lot of money. It doesn't really make a difference. They really have to put a priority on this. So we think there should be national legislation. We think we should like go for something like the 16 months they have in Sweden. U.S. employers can certainly afford it. They're rolling in dough. They don't know what to do with the amount of money they have. All they're doing is you know, buying back their own stock and consolidating power in their companies. And then as we just learned, you know, Amazon is not paying any taxes whatsoever. So there's plenty of money sloshing around in the system to provide some of these things. But, of course, we need a politics where we're making the demand and where our politicians are not beholden to corporate interests like insurance companies and big employers.
Jenny, do you have a few more minutes?
Yes.
All right. Jenny Brown is our guest. Her book is Birth Strike, and she'll be speaking in Tampa Monday night. Lori writes this question. By the way, if you've got a question for our guest, Jenny Brown, you can email us here in the studio, dj@wmnf.org, or you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Lori writes this. I'm thrilled with your guest and topic today. Is there evidence of child abuse or child neglect when women are coerced into having unwanted children? I was thinking that as I read the story of the Florida woman who scalded her baby to death. I was a foster care social worker and know that there are so many damaged children already, and they are thrown away as teens and then as adults. That's Lori's email.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we have to have humane conditions for people to raise their kids. And I think part of, you know, you see a lot of situations like this because people are so stressed and angry all the time because they just don't have the things that are needed to make their life livable. You know, the long hours, the stress of constantly having no money. Frequently, guys don't do their part. And, you know, I think it does lead to that kind of stuff. Although I would say that, you know, many parents who have kids that they didn't expect or hadn't planned are perfectly good parents. So, you know, it's not predictive of anything. But, I think that for our whole society, we're just in this stressed out, isolated situation many times, and it just results in all kinds of terrible things.
Do some countries pay people when they're on parental leave? And tell me what daycare costs in some of these other countries that are more pro-child.
Well, the system in France is that that basically daycare is subsidized for everybody who makes who is not rich, right? So you basically have a very easy access to childcare. There's never any question that somebody can afford childcare, and that's true in many countries. From the rich to the poor. The idea is if we're going to have women work, then we have to have some kind of childcare system that, you know, and usually it's a national system. It's kind of like the public schools. You know, the workers are unionized and paid well. It's not the system where that we have here, where it's very fragmented, and often people are just trying to get by, so they don't have childcare. So then they open up a childcare center in their home. They don't have any resources. They themselves are you know, have a living situation that's not good. So instead of doing that, we actually have well-funded systems in these other countries, and I think we could win that here. There's no reason why we couldn't if we got, you know, if we got a lot of women together. The problem is that I think that women are blaming themselves when they can't make it work. They're feeling like, oh gosh, if I could only get a better job, or if I could take some time off, or if I could, find some other living arrangement, or I'm just in the wrong place. Maybe I could move back where my parents live and they could help with childcare, this kind of thing. So we're all blaming ourselves rather than seeing it as a system that is set up to extract maximum unpaid labor from us, not to mention stress. That it doesn't have to be like this. In other countries, they've figured out other ways to do it. And I should say that they didn't immediately do that. I mean, France had anti-abortion laws and anti-birth control laws, and it had a lot of, repression. Eventually, it took a while, but eventually they figured out, well, if we want to have women work and take care of kids, then we need to make it possible for them to do that by providing these services.
Do other countries pay for people who are having children? Do they give like a salary or anything like that? Or do they force the companies to continue with the salary while the parents are on parental leave?
So the paid leave is usually 80 to 90% of your salary. So you're off for 16 months and you're getting that. In addition, they often have something called the child allowance, which is a check you get every month to cover the expenses for the kids. So it really boils down to getting a paycheck to raise your kid. And then in Sweden, you can go back to work at at three-quarter time or two-thirds time when your child is young. They also have extremely long paid sick leave and vacation, so you're never really like running out of sick leave or running out of vacation the way we're constantly doing here. And it's all paid for through like a system like Social Security, where the individual employer doesn't have the burden of paying for a worker who's taking leave, because that would mean that employers would be discriminating against people they expected to have kids, right? So basically, it's all they all pay in on a per capita basis, and everybody gets the leave. And I should say that's similar to what we do with Social Security here. When a parent dies, there's a check for the, you know, to make up for the parent, the lost income of the parent to help raise the child. So it's basically a really an expansion of that.
You know, Jenny, and I'm sure you think about this all the time, but here we've got this giant anti-abortion movement in the country. They control radio stations here in the Tampa Bay area. They certainly do it all over the country. They have TV networks and TV stations. They're pretty powerful in Tallahassee. They're powerful in Washington, D.C. They certainly have a control of the U.S. Senate and the White House. It's all about having babies, but once you're born, you're really on your own in this country. You know, your wages are low for many people. Health insurance is hard to come by for 30 million people. Daycare is almost unaffordable for anybody that's making $10 or $11 an hour. Why do you think that there's such an emphasis on having babies, but then not an emphasis on helping people once they're born?
I think it's all of a piece. If you look at, basically, they're trying to do it on the cheap. And if you look at what politicians say, for example, Paul Ryan, you know, what he was in 2017, he was sort of teeing up an attack on Social Security, one of many that the Republicans have done. And he said, you know, we have to have more babies in this country. I did my part, but you all need to have more babies. So, you'll hear this. Occasionally, politicians will burst out with this, which really makes it clear that not just about a religious opposition to abortion, as we can see with like the opposition to birth control, which is not really generally a big priority for religious folks, but it all comes down to the same root, that they want us to have the kids, but then they want the burdens and the costs to be born entirely by the family. And, you know, if they don't have to pay for it, they're not going to, right? Why would they pay for parental leave or childcare if we can be induced to do it on our own? But I think what the birth rate dropping shows, and what this informal, what we're calling an informal birth strike shows, is that this system is not working and it's not going to work. And even if you do try to force us to have more kids by making it harder to get birth control and abortion, that system will not work. And we really need to start to look at the ways that we can make it easier for people to do parenting in this country. So I think that that's sort of where the rubber hits the road, right? They don't want us to have reproductive rights, because then we can demand better. And the reason that, you know, people like the Koch brothers, who are nominally libertarian, are putting in money against birth control and abortion, is that they see this as an economic engine. They see growth in the economy as dependent on growth in the population, and they have it as an economic priority. And that's what we're starting to see with tremendous amounts of money put into anti-abortion and anti-birth control efforts, and also I should say sex education, the abstinence only sex education, which they know doesn't work to prevent pregnancy, but maybe that's the point.
Jenny, I understand about all the anti-abortion measures, but I forgot to ask you, and let me ask you right now, would you say that these same politicians that are anti-abortion are pushing anti-birth control measures or trying to cut back on sex education? Where especially is that happening in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, it's it's happening in red states, obviously. I mean, there was a big Supreme Court case around employers not having to cover birth control for their employees, and on the basis that it was a religious violation of their religious freedom. So you see a lot of that. You see often conscience clauses so that pharmacists don't have to prescribe birth control if they feel that it's against their religious beliefs. And we faced this when we were, I was involved in a 10-year campaign to get the morning after pill over the counter. We encountered this actually as sort of a bipartisan opposition to the morning after pill, which is after sex contraception. It works by delaying ovulation, so it's not an abortion. We expected opposition from the Bush administration, but then our campaign was still going when President Obama got elected, and we also had opposition from the Obama administration. In fact, they went against their own FDA on making this more available. So that was when we started to say, why is opposition to birth control starting to be a mainstream thing that's happening once again? I mean, it was certainly true for 100 years that birth control was very hard to get in the U.S. It couldn't be prescribed. Married people only doctors. It couldn't be displayed. And we've had a lot of fights around birth control throughout this century. And now these fights are sort of coming back. And so that's when we started to really investigate, why is this happening? Because it just doesn't seem to make sense. But if you put it all together with, they're trying to get us to do this work without actually putting any of the resources that would make it tolerable, the picture starts to come through.
Jenny Brown, thanks for coming on WMNF. I know you'll be speaking on Monday at 6:30 p.m. at the National Nurses United Hall, 1406 North 19th Street in Tampa. Do you have a website do you have a website?
So womensliberation.org is our website. And I also have a blog at birthstrike.blog that has some articles and more information about the book. And I should say the book is out from PM Press. And a great publisher out of Oakland, and I recommend going to their site as well, PM Press.
Jenny Brown, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. That's Jenny Brown. She's the author of the brand-new book, Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work, and she looks at this issue, why is the birth rate in the U.S. reaching an all-time low? In 2017, it reached that level, and she'll be speaking Monday night at the National Nurses United Hall in Tampa, in Ybor City. Well, we're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org, and we can talk about this issue. There's some other issues, too, I think we should bring up and see where you want to take this conversation. In Tallahassee, lots of news coming out of Tallahassee. First of all, The FBI will soon meet with Senator Rick Scott and Governor Ron DeSantis to discuss the agency's suspicion that Russians hacked at least one county here in Florida during the 2016 presidential election. The suspected hacking made public last week, and the report from the special counsel Robert Mueller has alarmed Florida officials who previously insisted that Russian hacking efforts had been unsuccessful. So we could talk about that. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. So if there's something you want to talk about. Also, there's a big move in Tallahassee about school vouchers. Florida's on the verge of creating a new school voucher program that's been a priority for Governor DeSantis. After the Senate passed a bill yesterday expanding existing programs that allow students to go to private schools at taxpayer expense, the bill would create what's being called family empowerment scholarships and make them available to lower-income families. The first year of the program would allow up to 18,000 students to switch from public to private schools at state expense. It would cost $130 million to taxpayers. The idea was hailed by Republicans, who say it gives parents more choice. The bill was blasted by Democrats, who said the bill would strip public schools of money and send students to schools that are not held to the same standards as our public schools. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. You can also email the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. In Maryland, a Coast Guard lieutenant accused of being a domestic terrorist is entitled to be released from custody before his trial on firearms and drug charges, according to a federal magistrate. The magistrate said yesterday that 50-year-old Christopher Hassan hasn't been charged with any federal terrorism-related offenses. Hassan was arrested February 15th. He's awaiting trial on firearms and drug charges. Prosecutors have said he created a hit list of prominent Democrats, two Supreme Court justices, network TV journalists, and social media company executives to kill. Prosecutors have said Hassan is self-described white nationalist who has espoused extremist views for years and intends to murder innocent civilians on a scale rarely seen in this country. Yet it looks like he will be released from jail today. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Danny in Tampa, our first caller today. Danny, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, Trump came out this morning in a press conference in front of the helicopters a little while ago before he went to address the NRA. And he said that that he never, ever instructed Don McGahn to fire up Mueller. So, you know, Don McGahn, of course, is subpoenaed to go testify, and they're trying to prevent him, which I don't think they can do, really. I really don't think so. But with this guy, you never know. It's unbelievable how these people give him everything he wants. But I think that if he does testify, all Don McGahn would have to say is, he would have to say it. He said it already publicly to Mueller under oath. Yes, I did. I did tell him to fire Mueller. And I think that would be an eye-opener for a lot of people. And I think that's what Trump is could really, really doesn't want that to happen. He also said that Joe Biden was too old and that he says, I'm a strong, I'm a young, vibrant man, he said. And he also said that Mueller was a Trump hater on top of that. So do you actually think that he can prevent Don McGahn from testifying, Rob?
Well, I think because McGahn has already testified and taken part in the Mueller investigation, I think it's going to be hard for the president now to claim executive privilege.
Yeah.
But I don't know. The president clearly wants to fight it. We'll see what happens. I would say that it would be in the public interest to be as transparent as possible. It is our government, right? It's not President Trump's government.
Transparent president and administration ever. And but I got a friend of mine who says that it seems like, you know, Nixon was, this was like Nixon. Nixon was refusing to give up everything. Remember, to give them everything, you know, until the hearings and they found out about it. And how does this guy get away with it? And that's what people don't understand. And I include myself too, Rob.
All right, Danny, asking the big questions. Thanks, Danny.
Have a good weekend.
All right, you too. Let's go to Nancy in St. Petersburg. Nancy, you're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Hi. Okay. Here we go. I was just doing something else. All right. I just want to say this. That Trump is innocent of obstructing Russians.
Okay, so President, he's innocent of obstructing Russians. Yeah, I think that's probably
that's
true.
Right.
He didn't obstruct the Russians. I think
not
that's
at
true.
All.
Yeah.
So, okay, just wanted to get that off my chest because I thought it was pretty funny. But anyway, thanks for bearing with me and laughing. Okay. Also, this is a terrible idea about the charter school scholarship thing. We can't make children or children's families compete for their child's education. That's just not right. That's all I want to say about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks, Nancy.
Good weekend.
All right.
Bye.
The headline, and this story is in the paper today, voucher plan advances. The headline in the Tampa Bay Times says that despite potential legal challenges, Florida Senate plows ahead with a bill that redirects funds from public schools. And the lead on it, as I mentioned before, the Florida Senate passed a massive education bill yesterday that marks a key departure from the state's traditional financing of public education. The measure passed along party lines, Senate Bill 7070. It's a major victory for advocates and parents wishing to expand different school options paid for by the state. It steers money from the state's per-student funding currently reserved almost solely for Florida's 67 public school districts into private school vouchers for students from low-income families called Family Empowerment Scholarships. The move is probably directly in conflict with a 2006 decision by the Florida Supreme Court. Florida has a history, because of its constitution, of not sending money to private schools. And that is embedded in our constitution. And previously in 2006, the Florida Supreme Court, that had a slight liberal majority, voted against this idea of providing public money to private schools. Now we have a new Florida Supreme Court, and it is solidly conservative. So we'll see what they do. They may overturn that 2006 decision by the Florida Supreme Court. Let's go to Amy in St. Petersburg. By the way, our phone number is 813-239-9663. And Patty Perkey and Frank Knox are behind the scenes making the show happen. Let's go to Amy in St. Pete. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Rob. Good to hear your voice.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. About the school vouchers, that is so interesting to me. I've done work around the city of St. Pete, and when I drive into a private school for the work that I do, maybe some construction work, there's like a ton of SUVs waiting to pick up their children from school. So I avoid getting there like at 3 o'clock, and just so many expensive cars and big cars picking up their kids from school. And, you know, so it's interesting that that money is going to go to where the affluent is and taken away. You go to schools in other areas where they're, all the kids are walking to school and they don't have a ride, let alone a nice big SUV. And so it's really sad to take that money away from where it's needed and put it where it's not necessarily needed.
Yeah, you know, this year we had a teacher shortage. We couldn't attract enough teachers to work permanently in our public schools. Next year, the shortage is going to get even bigger. I think next year they're projecting 7,000 vacancies in teaching positions around the state. We pay less money. I think last time I looked, we're 47th in teacher pay, so we're not attracting a lot of teachers. At the same time, too, a lot of kids in school these days are eligible for reduced lunches or free breakfast, too, and that's a sign of poverty. And so if we look around at our school districts, whether it's Manatee County or Sarasota or Hillsborough or Polk or Pasco or Pinellas, a lot of kids going to school these days, their parents are in poverty. So when
we've been asked by my employer to give cereals and cereal bars, and we're supposed to donate them to a particular place so that the kids will have some snacks when school is out.
Yeah, and to me, you know, it goes to the question of wages. You know, if more and more parents are working long hours for less pay, or maybe they're working two jobs for less pay, they can't be when the kids come home. If there is homework that the kids bring home, the parents can't supervise that homework, tell the little Janie or Johnny to, you know, get to work and do their homework like our parents might have done when we were younger. And any time that you have low income, there's a host of problems that go along with being low income. Some low-income families are successful, many are not, just because of the weight, the pressure of society on that low income. So the more low-income jobs we create, the bigger the problem it is, and it's a chain that includes public schools. So
Maybe some of these lawmakers should have to visit some of these schools to understand some of that lifestyle, because obviously they can't relate.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that when you go into the parking lot in Tallahassee and look at the legislators' cars, you're not looking at a 1982 Corolla. You're looking at a big Land Rover. You're looking at these giant SUVs that suck up the gasoline. Yeah, I think a lot of legislators don't really realize what people are going through today when they're working at the big box store. They may not have health insurance. They probably don't have a pension or an IRA, and they're working hand to mouth, paycheck to paycheck. And the problems redound to the schools, too. So we've got to solve that problem. We're creating plenty of jobs. They're just low-wage jobs with no benefits, and we've got to solve that problem.
Thanks, Rob.
All right. Thanks, Amy. Here's the open line. We got one open line, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Jackie in St. Petersburg. Hi, Jackie. You're on MNF.
Hey, I just wanted to, well, first of all, hi, Rob. I'm glad you're back. But I just wanted to say I have a coworker, and she pays $8,000 a year for her child to go to a private school. And then she told me they don't even provide lunch or snack or anything like that. So if low-income children are going to be going to schools on vouchers and they're in need of free lunch and such, how's that going to work?
Well, that's a good question. And you know, I don't know if you've been, have you ever been in school with rich kids?
A couple of public schools I went to were in zones of, you know, where they had a high population of rich, but no.
I've been one of those low-income students in schools with rich kids. It's very intimidating if the rich kid has plenty of money, maybe access to a car. It's very intimidating to go to that school, and when that kid needs to buy a book, it's easy to find the money. When you need to buy a book as a low-income person, it's a whole lot harder, and there's a lot of intimidation. So I do wonder how that works. I haven't talked to any parents who are low-income these days who are sending their kids to private school, but I think that's a really great question. I'll look into it.
Yeah, well, I did go to public school that did have, you know, higher income, and I hear what you're saying because I was a part of that lower-income population. And I did even have free lunch. And sometimes I was so embarrassed to get the free lunch because back then everybody knew, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I wouldn't even eat it.
Yeah, you don't want to let people know that you don't have money. Jackie,
yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you. Good to hear from you. Let's go to Dave in Clearwater. And this is 88.5 FM, by the way. It's 3 minutes before 12 noon. Dave, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. I was talking about the charter schools and yeah. money. I think we should be more concerned about what public schools do in terms of education than the money and where it goes. I was a public school teacher for a while. I taught in private schools. I've been in rich districts. I've been in poor districts. But I think the overriding thing is that our standards are so low to get a high school diploma. Because after I quit teaching, I was tutoring at one of the local community colleges. And these kids, they had a high school diploma. They couldn't write a sentence. I was tutoring math. But they asked the foreman to look at their paper and said, it's not a sentence. It's not a paragraph. I mean, nothing. I couldn't tell them that, but.
I agree with that is a problem. I mean, I hear from community college professors who say the same thing to me. But tell me, how would you fix that?
You have to quit the graduating for social status. I mean, that's or social.
Shouldn't it start earlier, though? I mean, you know, a lot of parents aren't getting the word that if you read to your child when they're 0, 1, 2, 3 years old, they're going to have a whole lot better chance of acquiring language skills and math skills once they get into kindergarten and first grade. So we need to do a better job as a country, I think. The word needs to get out that as parents, we need to read to our kids from the get-go. And I don't think that word has gotten out. And kids who are read to at an early age have a huge advantage over kids who are not read to at an early age.
Well, they have a great advantage if they're from a regular household, you know, standard two things. But I taught kids that had, you know, their parents worked two jobs. It was on. The kids were, you know, they had a key to get in the house and home. It's got to be community involvement, not. I mean, you have to go beyond the individual level. A lot of people just can't do it, especially the poor.
Yeah, I think
you know they have the time to. I grew up in a house. My mother was home until I was in high school. She started working only because the people begged her to. So I was, you know, my father worked crazy hours, and you know we were very comfortable. It was a very standard household. But these other kids, you know, single parents. A lot of them had three kids in one class that were all stepbrothers of each other, all the same mother.
Yeah.
Different fathers.
I think there are successful families where you have single parents. Dave, thanks a lot. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. You know, I think we've got to figure out from 0 to 21 or 22 our education system. We haven't figured it out. I think we've got to do better. Let's go to John in St. Pete. John, we just have 20 seconds. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Love your show. I just wanted to say I'm a child of the public school system, and it did good by me. what I'm seeing right now is nothing but racism from the Republicans. We're trying to just leave it to the black kids, and it's horrible. People should stand up to this.
All right, John, thanks a lot. Yeah, schools are becoming more and more segregated these days. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment about this show, about this last hour, on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back Monday morning at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for Janelle. She's coming up next. She's going to be talking about the Democratic presidential primary race. That should be interesting. News is next. I'm Rob Lori. Have a great weekend. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland.